The road and footpath have almost disappeared, reduced by the downpour to islets of grit in a black lagoon of water. The rain is coming down heavier than ever, in its frenzy and force hardly like rain at all anymore, but rather the bodying forth of something awful, until now hiding out in the abstract, gathering strength there, awaiting its moment to hurl itself into the actual. A sense of impending doom is unavoidable. I break into a run, splashing past nightclubs and pizza restaurants, then leaving the waterlogged streets for the shadows of the square, where I instantly spot nothing. In the decorous Georgian enclave, all is calm. The cherry trees cast their blossoms softly against the night. Silence turns about the solemn axis of the oak tree like the moon through the houses of some rarefied red brick zodiac. My dash slows to a jog, then a plod. My heartbeat does likewise. And I see my fears for what they are, absurd, too absurd for words. Clearly the events of the day have taken their toll on me. Not even Paul would attempt a plan so outlandish, except for the plot of one of his unwritten books, maybe. I laugh out loud, there on a leaf-strewn street. I'm answered with a murmur of reproof from a covey of pigeons lodged in a dripping magnolia, and then the unmistakable sound of breaking glass. Dread thuds back into my ears. At the same moment, the grey boulders of the clouds roll away from the moon, and in the interval of light I see amid the Benzes and Jaguars parked around the square a large and anomalous white van. KGB Exterminations runs the legend of the side, with a picture of a terrorized mouse fleeing a man in a trench coat. I start to run again. William O'Hara's house is almost entirely dark, save for a dim glow from deep within. The garden is deserted, the front door undisturbed. It's still possible I've got it wrong, but then a gate leading to a side passage opens and a masked figure appears.
"What the?"
he says.
"What are you doing here?"
"What are you doing here?" I return with a sense of déjà vu.
"Dad?"
"Mon Dieu, what is he doing here?" "Look, Claude, I don't mean to be rude, but we're sort of in the middle of something here."
"What is about this racket making out here?"
A third figure comes shambling out of the shadows, dressed like Paul in black with a stocking over his head.
"What is this fucking Frenchman doing here?"
he demands when he sees me.
"It is not enough you bring your son. Who else is coming? Your wife? Your mother-in-law?"
"I didn't bring him," Paul hisses back. "I don't know why he's here. What the hell are you doing with that window?
You could hear it a mile away." "How can I concentrate with you people jabbering like babushkas out here?"
"You said you knew what you were doing." Paul jabs his finger at his accomplice.
"That was before I found out that as well as art heist, I must be babysitting,"
Igor shouts. I grab Paul's arm and point. A light has gone on in an upper floor of the house next door. Reluctantly, he stifles his retort. Igor, with an air of vindication, turns on his heel and disappears back into the black shadow of the house, from which a moment later further shattering noises ensue.
"Oh, that's great, Igor. Why don't we send up a few flares while we're at it? Put it on Facebook. Current status breaking into William O'Hara's house."
"Dad!"
The boy pulls at his hand until Paul hunkers down.
"Again?"
he says incredulously.
"Didn't you use the toilet in Igor's?"
"Igor's toilet is scary,"
Remington says sorrowfully.
"Well, you'll just have to hold on until..."
Ah, here we go. Above us, the front door swings open, a panel of deeper black in the tenebrous facade of the house, as if the night were a series of nesting darknesses into which we were tunneling. Paul's son has already scampered up the steps, and his father after him.
"Wait,"
I hiss after them.
"Are you crazy?"
They are already out of sight. For a moment I remain hovering in the garden, then with a curse hurry inside. The house, so convivial and warm before, is as cold as a tomb. I pursue Paul's dim ghost down the hall as he shepherds Remington, who is clutching his bottom with both hands, into the bathroom. Depositing the boy on the toilet seat, he turns to me sternly.
"What are you doing here? Why do you have to keep sticking your nose in my business?"
"Because you are about to make a terrible mistake. If you steal that painting, you will never again have peace in your life."
"Oh, you mean like the fantastically wonderful piece I'm enjoying now?"
"K
getting into my own home by the fire escape to avoid the bailiffs. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
I know you have problems, I say as he wipes the boy's bottom. But this isn't the way to solve them.
Fuck you, pal. If you were so concerned about my problems, why didn't you help me with the website?
His eyes bore into mine.
You promised you'd pitch to your clients. Did you tell anyone? Did you tell a single person?
I gape back at him dumbly.
See? With friends like you, no wonder this is what I'm reduced to.
It's been busy and my investors. It's not as simple as just calling them up. He grunts disgustedly, refastening Remington's trousers and scooping him into his arms. But what about your proposal? I say, Ulysses II. He grimaces.
Let's just say I came to my senses.
What do you mean?
I mean, if I'm going to prostitute myself with some idiotic idea, I at least want to make some money from it.
But there would be money, I call after him. Dodson would pay. Look at this place. Doesn't it prove a writer can still have a good life?
He rounds on me so sharply I almost crash into him.
What are you, a child?
His eyes flash at me through the darkness. You think O'Hara paid for all this with his crappy books?
Don't you know who Crispin is?
I have no option but to gape again.
He's one of you. He's on the board of the bank that gave me my loan. Every time I open one of their eviction notices, there's his name in the small print on the bottom of the page.
He turns away again.
So you'll forgive me if I don't shed any tears.
What about Clitzia? You think she wants a thief for a husband?
I'm hardly going to tell her, am I?
So what will you tell her? That you're still working on your book? You're going to lie to her for the rest of your life?
He spins around again.
Jesus, will you get off my case? You're not going to make me feel guilty about this. If I was some big bank going bust, I'd have governments around the world throwing money at me. Instead, because I'm just some ordinary defenseless Joe Schmo, I'm left to rot. Society has given me no choice but to steal this painting, so will you please get out of my way?
I want to tell him what I learned in the club. That alone might make him think again, but the words stick in my throat. Somehow Clitzia's secret career seems much more damning than infidelity. And even if he knew her intentions, he has missed his chance with Dodson, so what could he do to make things right? A door flies open. Igor barrels out like a methylated Sasquatch.
What is delay?
He rasps.
Hurry, hurry!
I follow them into a room I recognize from our previous visit. Over the fireplace hangs the mark and the void, its myriad darknesses sparkling blackly. My skin prickles in response, making me shiver.
Dad, can I help steal the painting?
We're not stealing anything, it's a trick, remember? We're just playing a trick on Daddy's friend. Now why don't you sit down there on the couch and watch the TV? Paul goes over to the corner and switches on the set. Remington sits down dutifully.
A child at an art heist.
Igor grumbles again.
Who has heard of such a thing?
Who's heard of getting a babysitter for an art heist?
Bull rejoins.
Plus, do you know how much they cost these days?
That's a false economy,
Igor bellows. But Paul holds up a hand, cutting him off. Wait a second, he says. A familiar voice is issuing from the TV.
We live in a civilization in the late stages of necrosis,
it is saying.
What we take for life is in actuality is decomposition.
Dad!
Shh!
Technology is the noose that mankind swings from.
A bronzed, austere face fills the screen.
Too in love with its own erection to notice it is being asphyxiated.
Dad, this isn't cartoons!
Shh, be quiet.
And the writer, where does he fit into this?
Prompts another, more diffident voice. Belonging, I realize, to the man whose living room we are currently standing in.
The writer is the most tragic figure of all,
Bimal Banerjee says.
The parasite that does not realize its host is dead.
Speak for yourself, pal, Paul tells the TV. Can you believe people actually pay money to hear this guy? It's like getting a civics class from Charles Manson.
Hey, let's get to work,
Igor claps his hands.
All right, all right.
In the faint glow of the television, the Tixier radiates a strange and not entirely wholesome luster, a kind of paradoxical dark light that, as I draw near, makes the two men look shadowy and insubstantial.
What we call progress is in fact a vast and unprecedented project of dissociation,
Banerjee intones from the television.
A separation into individual units technologically cocooned.
You're sure it's not alarmed?
Igor growls, studying the back of the canvas.
That's what he told me, though that was a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Igor decides, and in unison both men raise their hands to the frame.
No!
I cry, but it is too late. They have lifted the painting away from the wall and lowered it to the floor.
Where nothing is at risk, what need is there for art?
Banerjee says.
Ach, I leave knife in van!
Igor says,
Hold on, I return.
He clumps out of the room. I turn quickly to Paul.
There is still time to stop this. Think, even if you get away with it, what does it bring you?
If Igor's buyer comes through, 25,000 euro.
He looks down at the painting. Laid out on the carpet, it resembles a fissure, a personalized abyss we are about to tumble into.
And you genuinely believe this will solve all your problems?
No, but it'll solve 25,000 of them, he says.
But people still want stories.
On screen, William O'Hara is looking bewildered.
Oh yes, they still want stories,
Banerjee replies.
But increasingly those stories are coming from the third world, from the past, from the lives of people who have not yet sold their souls to machines. More and more art resembles a kind of narrative colonialism. That is why I have come to my decision.
What decision?
William O'Hara asks.
What decision?
Paul echoes.
To stop writing.
Banerjee says.
Ha!
Paul exclaims.
Stop writing.
On the TV screen, William O'Hara is agog.
I do not see my art as a consumer product,
Banerjee says.
Therefore, I am removing it from the marketplace.
Can't take the heat, eh?
Paul jeers at the TV, evidently without awareness of any irony.
But surely the writer has a duty.
William O'Hara takes off his glasses and rubs his eyes.
That is, we can't simply abandon the world to its fate.
It is only when it has ceased to beat that the world will recognize literature was its heart,
Banerjee says.
But that is no longer my concern.
The revelation has clearly stymied O'Hara, who's turned a dangerous-looking shade of pink. The Indian places a hand on his knee and says,
Don't worry, for those who are willing to sell themselves, there is still plenty of money to be made.
At this, the older man's face goes from pink to brick red. But how he responds, we do not find out, because now, from behind us, there comes a long, strangulated cry. Igor has returned from the van. He is crouched over the painting, gazing at it in horror. Following his eye down, we see newly emblazoned in large green letters across the black canvas, Remington.
It wasn't me,
Remington pipes up preemptively. Paul emits a cry of his own.
Oh, God, Remington! I spelled it right!
Remington points out. Igor kneels over the desecrated painting in a convulsion of rage and grief, like King Lear over Cordelia.
No,
he whispers, dabbing at the green letters without effect.
No. No!
Maybe they won't notice,
Paul ventures.
Not notice?
Igor's eyes flick up balefully.
Not notice? I mean,
Paul says, backing away as Igor rises to his feet.
They might think it's just, you know, modern.
I give you something to notice.
Igor howls, lunging after Paul, who dodges behind the television, where interviewer and interviewee are glaring at each other in silence. And it has just occurred to me to wonder whether the broadcast is live when the door flies open and the lights blink on. And there in the threshold, as if he has escaped from the screen, is Bimal Banerjee. For a long moment he gazes down at us. Then, with a malefic grin,
So,
he exclaims. From his tone it is plain that even if he does not understand the full significance of the scene, he sees with a torturous instinct an opportunity to inflict pain.
So,
he declares again with relish, and hands on hips he swaggers into the room. But almost immediately he comes to a stop, then he crumples to the ground. Curiously, it is only after the fact that I realize what has happened, namely that I have hit him on the head with a bronze statuette of a faun. Now he lies on the ground, utterly motionless.
Jesus, Claude, what have you done? What's wrong with the man, Daddy? Claude's killed him,
Paul whispers, then looks up at me.
You've killed Bimal Banerjee.
Without a word, Igor dashes to the window, throws up the sash and jumps out. We should probably think about doing the same, but already another figure has appeared in the doorway. Paul's editor, Robert Dodson. Now it is his turn to take in the scene, piece by piece. The curtain flapping at the open window, the painting on the floor with scissors, Stanley knife, plastic sheeting arranged about it. Paul's stocking rolled back over his head and me still clutching the sexually explicit sculpture. And lastly, the celebrated author himself lying prostrate on the carpet, although I am glad to see, still breathing. Nobody says a word. Then, from the TV, the pre-recorded Banerjee pronounces,
"The problem with British publishing is that it is run by dinosaurs whose whole intelligence is absorbed in avoiding evolution."
Robert Dodson frowns gently, sampling this thought just as one might the bouquet of a fine wine, then stepping over Banerjee's prone body, he shakes his umbrella into the fireplace, turns to us and says,
"So I take it you've come to talk about the book."
Thinking about it, it strikes me that this could be the best of all possible outcomes. To have stolen the painting would have been a disaster, the beginning of a new and unending story of guilt, paranoia, and pursuit. To have bungled it in any other way than we did would have meant disgrace and very probably prison sentences. Instead, Robert Dodson takes care of everything. It's as if he's been tidying up botched art heists all his life.
"Might just stick this back on the wall,"
he says as if to himself, picking up the textier.
"It, fell down,"
Paul says gruffly.
"Oh, yes, yes, they'll do that,"
Dodson agrees.
"A friend of mine works in the Tate. It's a real problem. Hello, who's this?"
From behind the curtain, Remington steps out, his mouth smeared with the same green pigment with which he recently augmented the painting.
"This is my son," Paul says reluctantly.
Dodson says. He looks at the canvas, then at the boy.
"Might his name be Remington?"
"It might,"
Paul confesses.
"Right, right. Well, if you could just give me a hand to get this chap back into place."
The defaced painting is surprisingly heavy. We stagger over to the mantel and, gasping, hoist it back up onto its hooks. Dodson steps back and considers it. "Remington," blares expensively back at us.
"Tell you what,"
he says, and then, without elaborating, bends down, scoops a handful of soot from the fireplace and smears it judiciously over the sprawling letters.
"I mean, it's intended as a dynamic sort of a piece, changing over time and so forth,"
he says to me.
"Interaction with the environment."
I agree.
"This is exactly the kind of thing Texier intended."
As he makes a few more minor adjustments, he explains that William and Crispin are still at the festival, but that Bimal Banerjee had contracted a migraine after the interview.
"He said it was probably the high concentration of mediocrity,"
he tells us deadpan. "But I'm glad, because it means we can finally have a chat about anal analyst." Paul, hearing this, looks guiltier than he did when apprehended stealing the painting.
"I must say, ever since you mentioned it that night, I haven't been able to stop thinking about it,"
Dodson says.
"Perhaps I could tease a few more details from you, characters, a rough idea of the length, and so on."
Paul lets out a long sigh.
"Look, Robert, there is no anal analyst."
"There isn't."
The editor looks confused. I am confused, too.
What's he doing? He's been offered a lifeline. Why doesn't he grab it? And then, almost simultaneously, it hits me. Paul doesn't want a lifeline. He has never wanted a lifeline. The real goal of the heist and his other ludicrous schemes isn't to haul himself out of the water. It's to scupper the ship, to find rock bottom, to rid himself once and for all of any last vestiges of hope. The failure of his last book crushed him so thoroughly that he would rather steal a painting, be caught, disgraced and imprisoned, than write another one and see it fail too. But this time I am not going to let him sabotage himself. "What he means," I interrupt, "is that since we saw you, the book has been significantly changed." "Oh, yes."
Dodson's interest is piqued anew. "And improved," I say, Paul is glaring at me, but I ignore him. Instead of a promiscuous gay man, the book now tells the story of a banker who falls in love with... I trail off. The implausibility, the unwritability of a love story set in the IFSC suddenly seems incontrovertible. But what to put in its place? Fragments of abandoned narratives float surreally about my mind's eye, detectives, wombats, James Joyce firing a revolver. My mouth opens and closes. Dodson considers me doubtfully. Paul's glower transmutes into a smirk, and then, in a moment of perfect simplicity, it comes, or rather, it has been there all along. It tells the story of two men, I say. The first is a lonely banker who spends his days making money and his nights searching for something to spend it on, a perfect circle of meaningless consumption. He has no friends, no family. Maybe he is running from something in his past or trying to fill some loss with possessions. Or maybe he works simply so that he doesn't have to think. But then he meets a writer who says he wants to put him in his book. For the first time, the banker begins to come out of his ennui in reality, though the writer is planning to rob the bank. Ha! Dodson barks appreciatively while Paul twists his mouth up and mutters under his breath. At first, the two men seem very different. The banker is successful, solitary. His life is dominated by money. The writer has a family but struggles to make art in a time when everything is defined by its price tag. Beneath the surface, though, both men are driven by the same urge to escape. The writer hides behind his failure just as the banker hides behind wealth. They have lost faith in the world and in themselves. I avoid looking at Paul when I say this, though I can hear his ever more irritated sighs. For this reason, even though his book is just a trick, the writer and the banker become friends, and with this friendship they begin to bring each other back to life. So it's a love story, Robert Dodson says with a smile. I suppose you could call it that, I agree bashfully. Through the banker, the writer is inspired to start writing his book for real. Yes. The editor brings his hands together. I can see it. It's all about giving, isn't it? The writer gives the banker companionship. The banker gives the writer faith. The writer begins a new book about the banker, the same man he once believed was nothing more than an empty shell. And he gives that to us. We realize it's the very book that we're now holding in our hands. Yes, yes. I listen to this grinning with a sense joyous as it is inexplicable that everything has come together, all problems solved. Then Dodson looks back at me and says, And the banker? What? The banker, what happens to him? What happens? He can't just go back to the office after all that, can he? No, no, of course not. No, the banker... He can't go back to the office, I can see that, but as to what he should do instead... The banker... Dodson slowly nods his head, willing me on, but it's no good. My mind has gone blank, and no matter how I try, all I can see is the banker at his desk, obediently tending to his work, his terminal full of numbers. The banker has to... He has to... That's enough, Paul says. I slump, gaze back at him wretchedly. Paul turns to the editor with a stony countenance. He's just trying to cover for me. The truth is that when I said, there is no book, that's exactly what I meant.
There's no book?
Dodson's kindly clever face puckers in incomprehension.
There's no book. Claude is not my life partner. We've never been to Sweden. I don't write anymore, Robert. I haven't had a saleable idea in 7 years. I didn't come here tonight to talk to you about a manuscript. I came here to steal that painting.
Oh, Dodson says. His brows furrow and knead together as though masticating this information. Then once again the door opens and William O'Hara enters in a state of panic.
The window in the alley smashed!
He exclaims, then notices our presence.
Hello,
he says.
Bumped into these boys out for a walk.
Dodson breezes.
Ask them in for a minute, hope that's all right. Out for a walk?
William O'Hara repeats, rainwater dripping off his coat into a pool at his feet.
Yes, babysitting this little chap here. Can't sleep, poor thing. Anyhow, they wanted to say hello.
We were very sorry to miss the interview. I chip in.
Count your blessings,
William O'Hara says. He steps back, inspects us thoughtfully. Remington is chewing on his crayon. The rolled-up stocking is still perched on top of Paul's head like a tiny beige beret. O'Hara clears his throat. He appears to be on the point of asking a question that I suspect will prove very hard to answer, when he is distracted by a groan.
Who's that?
He says, and then peering over the couch.
What's Banerjee doing on the floor?
Touch of migraine, Robert Dodson says.
Oh,
William O'Hara says. He sounds cheered. He takes another look at the felled author and says brightly,
Well, who's for a drink?
We should bring this little boy home, I say.
Suit yourselves,
O'Hara says.
I'll let you out.
He turns for the door, then, as if it has yanked at his sleeve, turns back again and stares at the mark and the void. He remains staring for what seems like a very long time.
You know,
he says at last,
I don't mean to sound like I'm bragging, but every time I look at that painting I see something new.
He shakes his head proudly.
That's a real work of art,
he says. Igor and the van are long gone, and neither of us has any cash, so there is no choice but to walk back towards the river. The rain has restarted and descends on us in enormous, drenching globules. The mood, it need hardly be said, is low. You should not be disappointed, I tell him. From what I have read, art theft is a very hard crime to pull off. Paul nods morosely. It's Igor I feel bad for, he says. He was going to buy a hot tub.
Dad?
Remington is rubbing his eyes with his fists.
Okay, buddy, we'll be home soon.
He hoists the boy up, letting his small head fall on his shoulder.
Listen, Claude, I appreciate what you were trying to do back there with Dodson. For the record, though, if there is one thing people want to read about even less than a French banker, it's a novelist struggling to write his new book.
If I ever pretend to submit a book proposal again, I will keep that in mind.
Seriously, I know you mean well, but your box office poison, he says, then adds, I'm sorry it didn't work out.
Me too, I say. We reach the quays. The wind batters us as we cross the river. Below us, the water foams seawards, throws spume up over the walls to deluge the bronze figures of the famine sculptor and their modern-day doubles a few yards away, the city's cadaverous addicts, huddled in the negligible shelter of the trestle bridge, while from the roof of the custom house the golden statue of commerce looks over the city. What will you do now? I say when we get to the far side.
I'm not sure, he admits. I'll go back to my hot waitress, but right now I need something that'll bring in money, like tomorrow.
How much is it you're looking for?
More than you've got, Claude. He says it with a smile, as if he wants to reassure me, as if I might have felt compelled to pay off his mortgage for him, had I the funds, though this isn't something that really happens, is it, even between friends?
Not in the real world.
We'll muddle through somehow, he says. We always do.
At that moment, there comes a bleep from his pocket. With his free hand, he takes out his phone.
Well, there's some good news, he says, reading the message. Clitzia's won her volleyball game. That means they're through to the final.
How wonderful, I say as my lungs fill up with cement.
You know, win or lose, I think she'll be glad when it's finally over. All these late nights,
he chuckles to himself.
And the other night she got an elbow right in the face, swelled up into a massive shiner.
Yes, I say, betraying no emotion.
The point is, I suppose I should look on the bright side. I might be unemployed and broke and about to be evicted, but I still have my family right. I mean, in some ways, I'm probably the richest man you know.
Definitely, I say, looking away to where the river, gorged with the night's rain, charges triumphantly like an army putting its enemies to rout. We shake hands, make vague promises to meet again, then Paul turns, child in his arms, towards the north. I stand and watch him disappear into the waves of rain, seeming to walk right out of the world, as if there were no more of his story left to play out. Continuing down the quay, I discover a carambar in my pocket. The joke on the wrapper is the George Clooney one again. On my phone, a baffled message from Ish asking if these crazy stories about Agrobot buying out Royal Irish are true. Several humorous texts from co-workers, increasingly incoherent as the celebrations go on. A long voicemail from Walter Corless, ranting that the Caliph still owes him money. He makes no mention of Agrobot's death and resurrection, as if the events of the last 2 days had never happened. Maybe, from his perspective, they never did. I delete the message, turn the phone off. What happens to the banker? Nothing happens to the banker. The banker is paid to be a person to whom nothing happens. Walking across the plaza, I see an A4 page in a plastic protector taped to the metal shutter of the Ark, thanking the cafe's customers for their loyalty and wishing them well. A customer. That's all I amounted to in the end. Her customer. Paul's customer. Someone who pays his money, takes his goods, and then walks away. Now the glass citadel of Transaction House rises before me, shimmering through the rain like a ghostly privateer. I think about Ishi's tribe scouring the waves for souls to make away with. Tomorrow we will be back in business. I can hardly bear to think about it. As I pass the door, though, something stops me, pulls me back. What is it? The security desk is unmanned, the lights are off, all is in darkness. Yet some strange energy emanates from within, tugs at me with invisible fingers. Without knowing why, I push the door and find that in all the excitement it has been left ajar. Inside, the strange pressure only grows, and as I climb into the lift, I feel the same tension a surfer must feel, stalking barefoot over the shingle while a storm brews above the waves. Still hidden in the clear skies, but there to touch, an electricity that crackles along the surface of the water, a blanket of static beneath which every drop buzzes. I step out onto the sixth floor. No one is here. No Asia team, no frantic interns, no midnight strategist building some invincible trade. I walk through the desks feeling like a visitor from the future, a tourist in some bureaucratic ruin. On my desk I see Walter's checks and bank drafts, the ones he gave me a couple of days ago, still sitting there, uninvested. I never did anything with them. With the bank going down, there hadn't seemed a point. Is there a point now? Am I going to do this? Somewhere out in the night, a clock strikes 13. The next day, the storm has lifted. The office is filled with sunshine. It slants through the windows in great radiant sheets, burnishing white shirts to such a brightness that from certain angles the room appears to be filled with angels, floating about their heavenly station reciting beatific litanies of numbers. I still don't get it, Ish says. I thought we were going bust. How can we buy a bank if we're going bust? And why would we want to buy Royal Irish? Optics, Gary McCrum says, sucking a chalk ice, leafing through a watch catalogue. Now that we've been rescued, everyone's acting like they expected it all along. Okay, for the last time, Jocelyn says heavily. Everyone knows Royal Irish is dead in the water, right? But the government's been afraid to let it go under because the whole world will hear about it and no one will ever put their money in this country again. So, a buyout like this suits them perfectly. They can proclaim the bank's been cleaned up enough to sell on, Royal's absorbed into a well-respected firm, its name is never spoken again, everyone gets on with their lives. But what's in it for us? Why would we buy Royal if it's such a basket case? Because we're not really buying it, is the answer. The doomed investments, the enormous book of bad loans, the copious lawsuits, as well as Walter's festering 25% stake, have all been quietly parceled up and transferred to a government agency. Basically, all we're buying is the name and the HQ building there. Jocelyn jabs his thumb at the monolithic edifice on the far quay, presently invisible behind the window dazzle. And we're getting it for practically nothing, Gary adds. The site alone's worth twice what we're paying.
But still, isn't Agrobot broke? What about all that Greek debt? Well, this is the clever part of the deal. At the heart of its extremely complicated mathematics is a swap. In return for taking the PR millstone that is Royal off their hands, the government has agreed to exchange all of Agrobot's toxic waste for guaranteed state bonds. They're just going to take it from us? Ish says incredulously.
I'm not sure they know what it is, Jocelyn says. They know, Gary contradicts him.
Then why would they take it?
Gary lifts up his watch catalogue, puts his feet on the desk.
Not their decision anymore, is it?
He says, rolling the stick of his chalk ice with his tongue.
Whose decision is it? The IMF, the EU, the ECB, some other conglomeration of acronyms?
That is not for us to know. The bottom line is that our balance sheet will be clean again and Agrobot made whole, and the Irish people, along with their unstaffed hospitals, their potholed roads, their overstuffed classrooms, medieval prisons, dying pensioners, will become the proud owners of 6 billion euros worth of, as Jocelyn likes to call it, radioactive Greek shit. This doesn't go unremarked upon. Though the government tries to spin it as a happy ending for Royal Irish, many commentators see the Agrobot bailout for what it is, and are asking why Ireland has been lumbered with rescuing a bank that is not itself Irish, nor European, nor, when it comes down to it, in the Northern Hemisphere. A more pressing point is that Ireland simply cannot afford to take on Agrobot's debts. The deal, if it's voted through, will effectively bankrupt the country. So why are they doing it?
My surmise is that taking on Agrobot's debt is the condition of Ireland receiving aid from higher up,
Jürgen says.
So they're deliberately bankrupting themselves so they can get a handout from Europe? How does that make sense?
You are perhaps making the mistake of judging Irish actions by an external standard.
Jürgen's smile has the same brilliant opacity as the sunlight in the window.
You must remember that unlike the French, the British, the... with a little cough, Germans, the Irish have never commanded their own empire. For the greater part of their history, they have been the subjects of foreign powers. Of course, we must go through the motions of equality and so weiter. But the fact is that the Irish are at root a slave race. We have seen this during their brief period of good fortune, when they are acting like the servant who has found the key to the wine cellar while his master is away. Even then, it is clear that they are not fit to be rulers of themselves, and they do not wish it either.
This is why, although it seems to you and me the terrible injustice, they will carry their new debt without grumbling, even with gratitude.
They'll be grateful for paying off Agrobot's debt?
Exactly so. Do not forget, Claude. This is a country until very recently ruled by priests. Thanks to them, the Irish already believe they are born in debt, a terrible debt of sin which they can never pay in full. A people like this is more comfortable wrapped in chains. For this reason, I am believing the deal will pass through Parliament without issue.
Nevertheless, we must take no chances.
As we have seen in the last weeks, the public mood is unpredictable. Prior to next week's vote, it is more than ever important that the contents of your original report on Royal Irish are forgotten. The IT department has taken the liberty of destroying all related material on your hard drive and on the Agrobot servers. You will do the same with any files on external drives or your own machine.
All right.
I must tell you, Claude, you have impressed a lot of people with your handling of this matter. Yes, with the initial report you have badly miscalculated, but after that you have made the case to the media very convincingly.
You mean I lied?
Sometimes for the greater good it is necessary to bend the truth a little. For a society to prosper, it's the strong, not the weak, that must be protected. The journalists will not understand this, of course, but those who know are not forgetting your contribution. You have a bright future here at Agrobot. Very, very bright.
He returns his gaze to the window. Across the water, the white sky glows in the unfinished windows of the Royal HQ, blind eyes shining through a concrete mask.
Beautiful, isn't it?
I am too surprised to reply.
True, it does not look like much now.
Jürgen considers.
But in a few years, the housing market will recover, unemployment will fall, and the Irish will be clamoring once more for high-interest loans to fund their four-wheel drives and shopping trips to New York. At this point, I am predicting our new acquisition will prove very lucrative.
You mean the whole thing will happen all over again?
Yes, it will happen all over again, but this time we will be prepared.
He looks out at the river, the static cranes, the office blocks, as if any moment all of it will turn into money.
Life is so fucking beautiful,
he says. The market loves the coup de théâtre of the Royal Irish buyout. Although the Irish government hasn't yet signed off on the deal, Agrobot's share price has already begun to climb. In the days that follow, the bank's credit rating is upgraded and then upgraded again. The Wall Street Journal runs a feature on Porter Blankley with a picture of the CEO smoking a fat cigar and, quote, "When they say you're over-leveraged, that's when you buy another bank." According to this article, the deal was clinched over a round of golf with Ireland's political elite, in which Blankley, who flew in direct from New York and had not slept in 36 hours, made a par 5 in 2 shots before sinking a putt for an eagle 3. The rumor within Agrobot is that Howie and Grisha were responsible for the details. Although investors are demanding an investigation into the collapse of the ninth floor fund, word is they've already been spirited to New York to sit at Porter's right hand. None of this may be true. Still, visitors to the Uncanny Valley report that Rachel spends most of her time these days by the window gazing out towards the sea, like a lonesome maiden waiting for her sailor to come home. Does it need to be said that nobody follows through on his vows to leave banking and take up shoemaking, orphan husbandry, semi-professional paragliding, whatever else? Kevin is given a permanent contract. A solicitor's firm specializing in liquidation opens an office on the 9th floor. Skylark Fitzgibbon reappears in the form of a barrage of publicity pictures from Kokomoko, showing the first shipments of topsoil arriving on shore, rich loamy mounds that will become the greens and fairways of the golf course, smiling islanders beside her in blue Agron Torabundo t-shirts. So Blankley got away with it.
Got away with what?
Cashing in twice.
Not this crazy conspiracy theory again.
I'm just saying.
No one else is saying.
Everyone is just grateful to be back at work, and within a very short time, a matter of days, life is just as it was. Or almost.
Who is that man, Ish?
What?
The man there coming out of Liam's office.
Oh, the dude in black.
He's a new employee?
I think he's from compliance.
Compliance?
Yeah, I heard there's been someone snooping around the last couple of days, asking questions.
What about?
Beats me, wouldn't reckon it's got anything to do with us.
No, no, of course not.
You going somewhere, Claude?
Yes, I have a meeting. If anyone's looking for me...
Don't worry, I never saw you. The door doesn't open so much as implode at my knock, giving way to a seething mass of small children who run back and forth and bump into one another in an exemplary display of Brownian motion. Thanks for coming, Paul says, wading through them with me to the relative safety of the kitchen table. Sorry about the short notice. We weren't going to do anything, but then Clitzia's game got cancelled, so...
It's my pleasure,
I say. It's not every day that someone turns 5. Thank God for that. Here, let me see if I can...
He cranes over the swarm and plucks out his son, who is panting with excitement and partially covered with a recent meal.
Look who it is, Remington, it's your Uncle Claude.
Happy burp day, I say, handing him my present.
What is it?
It's an ant farm, I explain, where ants live. I help him remove the wrapping paper to reveal the plastic window through which ants may be seen running up and down tunnels with small objects in their mouths, occasionally stopping to flail antennae with other ants. The resemblance to the financial services center seems to me indisputable.
Is Roland in there?
Remington asks. There are certainly some ants that might be related.
Let's take them out.
Maybe later, his father says hastily, removing the box from the boy's hands and putting it on a high shelf. Remington shrugs and rejoins the anarchy.
So I have news, Paul says to me.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, Dodson called.
The first thing I think of is Banerjee. He's pressing charges? Or, my God, he's not dead, is he?
Relax, Banerjee's fine. They're all fine. No, he was calling about the book.
What book?
My book. He thinks it's got legs. He wants to publish it.
He wants to... I feel a sore of elation, though also a certain amount of confusion. There do seem to be a number of loose ends to this news. For example, that there is no book.
There is no book now, Paul corrects me. But after hearing our proposal that night, Robert says it's all right there.
His voice takes on a loftier tone, adding,
he says it's the book I was born to write.
He says Anal Analyst is the book you were born to write?
He's not 100% sure about the title.
Paul concedes. Well, I say, attempting to take this in.
And you don't... That is, in the past you have had some doubts about writing, the modern audience, competing technologies, that kind of thing.
Cold fate, that's all it was, Bull says dismissively. Does the blackbird sing for an audience? Does the sun rise in the hope that some douche will take a picture of it on his phone? I just needed someone to believe in me. That's what I've been waiting for all this time.
I believed in you,
I remind him. I know.
Krizia believed in you.
Yeah, well, someone who's professionally qualified to believe in me, I mean.
It strikes me that Robert Dodson believed in him the last time and he just never submitted the book, but I decide not to press the point.
And he will give you some money as well as belief. He needs a couple of pages first, just the basic setup to show the finance people. But once that's done, he's pretty sure he can scrap the previous advance and set up a whole new deal. Debt forgiveness, huh? They won't pay much, but get this, just a few days after I saw you, I got an email from this investment company asking about buying the apartment for cash.
This apartment?
Yes. I told them straight up it's got structural problems. They didn't seem to care. Serrano Solutions, you ever heard of them?
No, but there are all kinds of foreign investors in town buying up property.
I couldn't find anything about them online. It sounded kind of shady to me. But then the next thing I know, we get this huge wump of money into our account. I mean, just like that. And these people say we can wait and move out whenever. Isn't that crazy? Like, I wouldn't say our troubles are over exactly, but I'll be able to keep writing full time. At least till I've got a first draft. After that, maybe I can get a few gigs on the side, reviews, that kind of thing. You know, now that I got me bona fides again.
That is wonderful.
I clink his plastic glass.
Congratulations.
Thanks. We were sailing pretty close to the wind this time. Sometimes I even thought, well, why dwell on it? Suffice to say, it's nice to have some good news for a change. And a lot of it's down to you.
Me? I say through a mouthful of butterfly cake.
You assaulting Banerjee did me no harm at all. He didn't say it, but I got the distinct impression Dodson's been waiting to hit him with a sculpture for a long, long time. I reckon I could have given him the ABC after that and he still would have published it.
Au contraire, it's your talent.
So, the question now is how to end it,
Paul says as in a far corner of the room a synthesizer polka starts up and the children dance around. Dodson thinks he's got to rob the bank.
The banker?
He says it's the only ending that makes sense, after everything that happens.
I see. I say, a cold spiral of metal coiling up from my gut. So I wanted to run something by you. I know you said robbing an investment bank was basically impossible, but I've been reading about this guy in France, this Pierrot. You've heard of him?
Of course. The children are jumping up and down now, the noise so thunderous it almost drowns out the music.
He breaks into the back office in the middle of the night, forges some papers, transfers his client's money into his own account. Couldn't that work here?
The music stops abruptly. The children freeze.
Pierrot got caught, I say. He got greedy. He did it over and over. What if our guy only does it once, and he takes the money from some really evil client, so it wouldn't seem so much like stealing?
I stroke my chin. My fingers feel like ice.
It's true, if he put the money into a third party's account, it would be almost impossible for the bank to get back,
I say, forcing the words through numb lips.
And maybe if he was lucky, the client wouldn't find out till the end of year returns. Still, it would only be a matter of time. In theory, though, you could have it so that by the time the client finds out, they've got away.
They?
The banker and the waitress.
I feel a curious jolt as if the world has slipped from its wheel.
What about her boyfriend?
She doesn't have a boyfriend,
Paul says, erasing him with a single wave of the hand.
Maybe the banker thinks she has a boyfriend and that's what makes his sacrifice authentic.
But then he finds out the truth using a bespoke waitress surveillance system. Although Dodson's not 100% about that part either, he confesses.
Dad, we need you for past the parcel!
Remington appears at his father's elbow.
Oh, right.
But in principle, that'd work. The back office thing. They get away, a happy ending.
Yes, I think that would work very well.
Dad!
All right. Hey, try the dinosaur cake, Claude. It's unbeatable. He is pulled away. Left by the table, nibbling on dinosaur cake, I think about what he said.
Could they really escape, the banker and the waitress? Is there still somewhere in the world the bank wouldn't find them?
You look like one of the musical statues.
I turn around. Krizia has materialized beside me.
Just daydreaming, I tell her.
Enjoying the party?
I should get back to the office.
But I'm worried that if I move, I will stand on somebody.
They're tougher than they look,
she says with a laugh. Her hair is tied back, and instead of her usual micro-skirt, she wears a tracksuit liberally adorned with food smears and tiny fingerprints. The bruising around her eye has faded almost to nothing. Things are better, I say. She shrugs.
If he finishes book.
What about you? How are your travel plans? She shrugs again, though not without a smile.
We'll see. For now, everything is good.
No more volleyball? I pay off boss. She waits a moment after relaying this information, then says, Don't you want to know how?
Paul mentioned that you've sold the apartment?
She looks amusedly into my eyes, and for a moment our gazes crisscross, glancing off one another like bright swords in a duel. Then she takes my hand.
Come, before you leave, there's someone I want you to meet.
She scans the partygoers, then locates the one she is looking for beside the refrigerator. A small, olive-skinned boy with a blue stripe on the bridge of his nose and pink daubs on his cheeks.
This is one of Remington's friends from school, she says. Tell Claude your name, darling.
The small child looks up at me. He does not speak, he does not need to. His eyes are a brilliant, luminescent green, like light through the trees of some Olympian forest.
I think maybe you know his mother,
Clitzia says innocently.
She works in a cafe near your bank.
Is that right?
I stammer.
It closed, but then it opened again.
I see.
Someone gave them a whole lot of money.
Is that so? Good for them.
But they don't know who he is.
Well, that's the business world, so impersonal. Clitzia touches my arm, leans into me and says,
You're a good man, Claude.
Me? Oh, you mean the ant farm?
There are not many good men. So few that sometimes we forget even to look for them. We are too busy trying to pick out the best of the bad men.
I continue to make fish-out-of-water gestures of incomprehension, which Clitzia continues to ignore.
Oscar's mother will be coming to collect him in about half an hour,
she says absently, stooping to pick up a little girl who has collided with a dustbin.
If you are still here, you can all walk back together.
Ariadne? Here? With no more tricks or ploys or misunderstandings? For an instant it seems that life and story are merging at last into one, everything I hoped for coming true. But then my phone begins to ring, and I remember it's already too late for that.
Where are you, Claude?
Rachel's secretary is at the other end of the line. I had a meeting. A compact, merciless hammering of keys.
I can't see anything in your diary.
Yes, it was, unscheduled.
You're needed back at the office.
With regard to something in particular?
Just get back here, she says.
I step out of the lift to find the office submerged in a kind of silent panic, a frantic gloom that envelops everything like a fog. Through windows, around corners, senior management can be seen having agitated conversations, then hurrying off in different directions. I go to my desk, moving calmly, as if I am being watched. The man in black is in Liam English's office, interviewing staff.
One of the accounts got tapped,
Gary McCrum says in a low voice.
Whose?
Jocelyn Lockhart says.
How much was taken?
Gary McCrum shrugs.
What's going to happen?
Kevin asks. They're talking to everyone, Gary says. But I reckon they already know who it is.
Who? And how?
And how's he supposed to have done it?
I heard there was some security fuck-up the night of the margin call,
Brent Crude Kelleher says.
A bunch of doors got left open, including back office.
They think someone went in there?
They found something on the floor the next day.
I heard that too.
Terry Fusco joins in huskily, spinning round in his chair.
I heard they found a Goldman Sachs business card.
I heard it was a USB key,
Dave Davison says from the water cooler.
And on it there was a virus the IT people had never seen before.
It was a sweet wrapper, Thomas Ewan McGregor says. His eyes are bleary.
He has been summoned from his bed.
A sweet wrapper? What? Back office don't eat sweets.
At that moment, the office door opens and everyone falls silent. An apparatchik from sales emerges, looking pale and traumatized. He glances at us, then steps quickly away, fingering his collar. Liam English comes to the threshold with Rachel and the man in black. Rachel is holding a clipboard in a cursory way that makes it look like a prop. The man in black looks over the room. His eyes, quite without life or expression, pause on me. David Davison, Rachel calls.
Fuck,
Dave mutters, getting to his feet.
You think it was him?
Kevin says breathlessly once the door closes.
Dave!
They're talking to everyone, you tool, Gary says. Well, someone's in for it, Jocelyn says, then rolls back to his desk. The others follow suit. I turn to my terminal, where the numbers scroll across my screen, twittering among themselves like birds amidst a general silence so taut you could punch a hole in it. The lift doors open. Ish bounces across the floor, autumn air clinging to her coat.
Hey, guess what? The Ark's reopened.
Oh yes, I saw that, smiling at her queasily.
Want to come and have a look?
I don't think anyone's supposed to leave.
They're interviewing alphabetically. They won't get to us till midnight. Come on, Claude. A coffee at least.
My limbs are heavy as stone. I don't think I have the strength to go anywhere except maybe to hide under my desk. Ish, however, won't take no for an answer.
Pretty mental, isn't it? She says in the lift. You think it's true? Someone's pulled a Pierrot?
I shrug, burble nothings. I heard it was the Double X account, she says, and then, where'd you go earlier? I tell her about the birthday party and Paul's good news. For real this time. He's not trying to knock the place off again.
I don't think so.
Sounds like someone's beaten him to it anyway, Ish remarks.
I thought I'd feel better once I got into the fresh air. Instead, the dread only seems to intensify, sparking in my hair and teeth and fingertips.
Claude!
Ariadne throws her arms around me when we step through the door.
We're back, can you believe it?
Yes, it's very good. I stammer at her weakly.
An investor comes out of nowhere, gives us everything we needed. We don't even know who he is. I thought maybe it's someone you called.
One of my clients? No, I don't think so. She sits us, gives us menus, scampers away again. Ish gives me a long look.
All coming up roses for your mates today, isn't it?
I wrinkle my forehead perplexedly. Coming up roses?
She laughs. All right, never mind.
The Ark is aglow. The light seems warmer, the smell sweeter than ever before. The waitresses beam at each other as they pass with their trays. Even the customers seem enlivened, swiping their phones with a flourish, adding winks and grins to their presentations, treating themselves to an extra sachet of artificial sweetener. But the celebratory atmosphere only makes me feel more remote, like I'm a hole that's been cut out of the page.
So tell us about the book, then. Ish prompts. It's the same setup as before, all about you.
Well, about a fictional everyman, I say.
Working in a bank. And what's the story?
Paul has not decided yet, I say with difficulty, but he is thinking that perhaps the banker, robs the bank.
Robs it?
Yes. On the tabletop, my phone flashes awake a moment, then darkens again. Yes, only...
He fucks it up,
Ish says. My eyes snap up. Ish looks back at me expressionlessly.
He leaves something behind, she says. They're onto him straight away.
I gulp, cover it up with a sip of coffee that makes me gag in turn. That seems to be how the story's going, I admit. Ish's kind eyes study me with concern.
Bit of a downer, eh? Is an ending.
It's probably more realistic, I say stoically.
Couldn't there be a twist or something?
What sort of a twist? Ish looks down at her hands for a long time.
How about he's got a mate?
Who does?
The banker. He's got a mate, and his mate's got...
She's got something the bank doesn't want anyone to see.
Like what?
Like a report, she says. On a flash drive. Everything freezes. I feel my mouth drop open, my eyes stare like they're going to pop out of my head.
He told her to get rid of it, but she didn't. She continues, in the day the government's about to approve the bailout, she sends it to the newspapers. A shaft of sea light tumbles through the window, flashes from the last blonde streaks in her hair. The strangest sensation steals over me, as if an invisible sun hidden for decades behind an eclipse were for the first time coming into view. If people knew what the bank had been up to, it might be tricky to justify bailing it out, mightn't it? She muses. And without the bailout, well, it's goodbye bank. She glances over her shoulder in the direction of Transaction House, as if half expecting to see it crumbling into dust here and now. She'd lose her job. I am barely able to speak. She'd lose her job of being an asshole, she says. She'd probably be grateful. I flop back in my chair. The space around me has taken on a wild, kinetic feel as if it's gained an extra dimension. Why? I say. Eh? Why does she do it? Why did you do it? She returns. My cheeks flare. She softens. Some things are too big to fail, aren't they? Outside, the rainbow flag cracks in the wind. The blue air seems to tinkle as if with secret chimes. Thank you, I say. Just seemed like a bitter ending, she says. So what would you do next? It's not me, is it? It's the character. Okay, what does the character do in the epilogue? I can tell Paul.
I don't know, maybe she takes up anthropology again, goes back to the island, lives with the tribe, tries to help stop them being washed away.
That would work.
Then she meets a handsome island chieftain and falls in love.
Yes.
He's tall, has a nice body.
Of course.
And he's really good at racquetball.
Let me write this down.
What about you, Claude? What happens to you?
Before I can reply, Ariadne appears at the table with a plate of baklava. You want to try? She says. I have changed the recipe. She waits while we dig in with our spoons.
Fuck, Ish says. This is incredible.
Nostimo, I agree. Very nostimo. That's because this time I use Greek honey, Ariadne says, then adds, looking at me, once you taste it always, you will be coming back for more. With that, she dances away again. Ish raises an eyebrow. What? I say.
You need to ask her out.
In the book, you mean, I say, or in real life? Ish grins at me over her cup.
That's up to you, mate, she says. That's up to you.
This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited. Original unabridged book copyright at Paul Murray 2015. Recording copyright Penguin Books Limited 2015.